On the contrary, if conscience disapproves, the loudest applauses of the world are of little value. He boarded with a local physician, whose collection of medical books helped satisfy his insatiable appetite for reading. For a time, interest in the law seemed to fade, and Adams thought of becoming a doctor. But after attending several sessions of the local court, he felt himself irresistibly impelled to the law. In the meantime, he was reading Milton, Virgil, Voltaire, Viscount Bolingbroke's Letters on the Study and Use of History, and copying long extracts in a literary commonplace book. From his reading and from all he heard of the common talk in town, he found himself meditating more and more about politics and history. It was the time of the French and Indian War, when Americans had begun calling themselves Americans rather than colonists. Excitement was high, animosity toward the French intense. In one of his solitary reveries, Adams poured out his thoughts in an amazing letter for anyone so young to have written, and for all it foresaw and said about him. Dated October 12, 1755, the letter was to another of his classmates and his cousin, Nathan Webb. "All that part of creation that lies within our observation is liable to change," Adams began. "Even mighty states and kingdoms are not exempted. If we look into history, we shall find some nations rising from contemptible beginnings and spreading their influence until the whole globe is subjected to their ways. When they have reached the summit of grandeur, some minute and unsuspected cause commonly affects their ruin, and the empire of the world is transferred to some other place. Immortal Rome was at first but an insignificant village, inhabited only by a few abandoned ruffians. But by degrees it rose to a stupendous height, and excelled in arts and arms all the nations that preceded it. But the demolition of Carthage, what one should think should have established it in supreme dominion, by removing all danger, suffered it to sink into debauchery, and made it at length an easy prey to barbarians. England, immediately upon this, began to increase, the particular and minute cause of which I am not historian enough to trace, in power and magnificence, and is now the greatest nation upon the globe. Soon after the Reformation, a few people came over into the New World for conscience' sake. Perhaps this apparently trivial incident may transfer the great seat of empire into America. It looks likely to me, for if we can remove the turbulent Gallics, our people, according to exactest computations, will, in another century, become more numerous than England itself. Should this be the case, since we have, I may say, all the naval stores of the nation in our hands, it will be easy to obtain the mastery of the seas. And then the united force of all Europe will not be able to subdue us. The only way to keep us from setting up for ourselves is to disunite us. Divide et impera. Keep us in distinct colonies, and then some great men in each colony desiring the monarchy of the whole, they will destroy each other's influence and keep the country in equilibrio. Be not surprised that I am turned politician. The whole town is immersed in politics. At Harvard, he had tried keeping a journal. In Worcester, he began again in a paper booklet no bigger than the palm of his hand, writing in a minute, almost microscopic script, numbering the days down the left-hand margin, his entries at first given to spare, matter-of-fact notations on the weather and what little passed for social events in his new life. January 23rd, 1756, Friday. A fair and agreeable day. Kept school, drank tea at Colonel Chandler's, and spent the evening at Major Gardner's. January 24th, Saturday. A very high west wind, warm and cloudy. P.M. warm and fair. January 25th, Sunday. A cold weather. heard friend Thayer preach two ingenious discourses from Jeremiah 10th, 6 and 7, supped at Colonel Chandler's. Soon he was filling pages with observations like those on his small scholars and on the arrival of spring, with frequently sensuous responses to nature, to soft vernal showers, atmosphere full of ravishing fragrance, air soft and yielding. Increasingly, however, the subject uppermost in mind was himself, as waves of loneliness, feelings of abject discontent over his circumstances, dissatisfaction with his own nature, seemed at times nearly to overwhelm him. Something of the spirit of the old Puritan diarists took hold. By writing only to himself, for himself, by dutifully reckoning day by day his moral assets and liabilities, and particularly the liabilities, he could thus improve himself. Oh, that I could wear out of my mind every mean and base affectation, conquer my natural pride and conceit. Why was he constantly forming yet never executing good resolutions? Why was he so absent-minded, so lazy, so prone to daydreaming his life away? He vowed to read more seriously. He vowed to quit chewing tobacco. On July 21st, 1756, he wrote, "I am resolved to rise with the sun and to study scriptures on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday mornings, and to study some Latin author the other three mornings. Noons and nights, I intend to read English authors. I will rouse up my mind and fix my attention. I will stand collected within myself and think upon what I read and what I see. I will strive with all my soul to be something more than persons who have had less advantages than myself." But the next morning he slept until 7, and a one-line entry the following week read, "A very rainy day. Dreamed away the time." There was so much he wanted to know and do, but life was passing him by. He was 20 years old. "I have no books, no time, no friends. I must therefore be contented to live and die an ignorant, obscure fellow." That such spells of gloom were failings in themselves, he was painfully aware. Yet he was at a loss to know what to do about it. "I can as easily still the fierce tempests or stop the rapid thunderbolt as command the motions and operations of my own mind," he lamented. Actual thunderstorms left him feeling nervous and unstrung. By turns, he worried over never having any bright or original ideas, or being too bright for his own good, too ready to show off, and especially in the company of the older men in the community who befriended him. "Honesty, sincerity, and openness I esteem essential marks of a good mind," he concluded after one evening's gathering. He was therefore of the opinion that men ought to avow their opinions and defend them with boldness. Vanity, he saw, was his chief failing. "Vanity, I am sensible, is my cardinal vice and cardinal folly," he wrote, vowing to reform himself. By vanity, he did not mean he had an excessive pride in appearance. Adams was never one to spend much time in front of a mirror. Rather, in the 18th century use of the word, he was berating himself for being overly proud, conceited. "A puffy, vain, conceited conversation never fails to bring a man into contempt, although his natural endowments be ever so great, and his application and industry ever so intense. And I must own myself to have been to a very heinous degree guilty in this respect." By late summer of 1756, Adams had made up his mind about the future. On August 21st, he signed a contract with the young Worcester attorney, James Putnam, to study under his inspection for 2 years. The day after, a Sunday, inspired by a sermon he had heard, and also it would seem by a feeling of relief that his decision not to become a minister was at last resolved. He wrote of the glorious shows of nature and the intense sensation of pleasure they evoked. Beholding the night sky, the amazing concave of heaven sprinkled and glittering with stars, he was thrown into a kind of transport, and knew such wonders to be the gifts of God, expressions of God's love. But greatest of all, he wrote, was the gift of an inquiring mind. But all the provisions that he has made for the gratification of our senses are much inferior to the provision, the wonderful provision that he has made for the gratification of our nobler powers of intelligence and reason. He has given us reason to find out the truth, and the real design and true end of our existence. To a friend, Adams wrote, "It will be hard work, but the more difficult and dangerous the enterprise, a higher crown of laurel is bestowed on the conqueror. But the point is now determined, and I shall have the liberty to think for myself." He changed lodgings, moved in with lawyer Putnam, and while continuing his daytime duties at the Worcester schoolhouse, he read law at night, moving fast, too fast, he later thought, through Wood's four-volume Institute of the Laws of England, Hawkins's Abridgment of Cook's Institutes, Salkeld's hefty Reports, Cook's Entries, and Hawkins's massive two-volume Pleas of the Crown, in a single volume that weighed fully 8 pounds. "Can you imagine any drier reading?" he would one day write to Benjamin Rush, heavily underscoring the question. Putnam's fee was $100, when Adams could find it convenient. With the war continuing, much the greatest excitement in Worcester was the arrival of Lord Geoffrey Amherst and 4,000 of the King's troops on their way west to Fort William Henry on Lake George. They camped on a nearby hill, and for several days and nights life in the town was transformed. Writing more than half a century later, Adams could still warm to the memory. The officers were very social, spent their evenings and took their suppers with such of the inhabitants as were able to invite, and entertained us with their music and their dances. Many of them were Scotchmen in their plaids, and their music was delightful. Even the bagpipe was not disagreeable. "I then rejoiced that I was an Englishman, and gloried in the name of Britain," he would recall to a friend. How he might fare in the law was another matter. As he wrote at the time, "I am not without apprehensions." In the fall of 1758, his studies with Putnam completed, Adams returned to Braintree to move in with his father and mother again after an absence of 8 years. "I am beginning life anew," he jubilantly informed a Harvard classmate. He was busy catching up with old friends, busy with his share of the farm work, and preparing for admittance to the bar. For the first time he was on his own with his studies, and he bent to them with the spirit of independence and intense determination that were to characterize much of his whole approach to life. In his diary he wrote of chopping wood and translating Justinian with equal resolution. "I have read Gilbert's first section of Feuds this evening, but I am not a master of it," he recorded October 5th, referring to Sir Geoffrey Gilbert's Treatise of Feudal Tenures. "Rose about sunrise, unpitched a load of hay, translated 2 leaves more of Justinian, and am now reading over again Gilbert's section of Feudal Tenures," he wrote the day following, October 6th. October 7th, "Read in Gilbert." October 9th, "I must and will make that book familiar to me." October 10th, "Read in Gilbert. I read him slowly, but I gain ideas and knowledge as I go along." October 12th. "This small volume will take me a fortnight, but I will be master of it." Though full of opinions, he often found himself reluctant to express them. I was young and then very bashful, however saucy I may have sometimes been since, he would recall long afterward to Thomas Jefferson. Feeling miserably unsure of himself, he attended court in Boston, where, awestruck, he listened to the leading attorneys of the day, Jeremiah Gridley and James Otis, argue cases. But, as he explained to a friend in Worcester, the appeal of Boston was threefold. I had the pleasure to sit and hear the greatest lawyers, orators, in short, the greatest men in America, haranguing at the bar and on the bench. I had the pleasure of spending my evenings with my Harvard friends in the joys of serene, sedate conversation, and perhaps it is worth my while to add, I had the pleasure of seeing a great many and of feeling some very pretty girls. On the morning he found his way through the crooked streets of Boston to Jeremiah Gridley's office for the requisite interview for admission to the bar, Gridley, much to Adams's surprise, gave him not a few cursory minutes, but several hours, questioning him closely on his reading. With a kindly, paternal air, Gridley also counseled him to pursue the study of the law itself rather than the gain of it, and not to marry early. Adams was admitted to the bar in a ceremony before the Superior Court at Boston on November 6, 1759. And in a matter of weeks, at age 24, he had taken his first case, which he lost. In Braintree, as elsewhere in New England, much of town business was taken up with the commonplace problem of keeping one man's livestock out of another man's fields. And by long-standing custom, most legal matters were handled by town clerks and officials who, though without legal training, were thoroughly schooled in procedure, knowing to the last detail all that was required for writs and warrants, matters about which, for all his reading, Adams knew little. The case Lambert versus Field involved two horses belonging to Luke Lambert, a coarse, cocksure man whom Adams did not like. Lambert's horses had broken into the enclosure of a neighbor, Joseph Field, and trampled some crops. When Lambert crossed onto Field's land to retrieve them, Field called for him to stop. But Lambert, as Adams noted, waved his hat and screamed at the horses and drove away without tendering Field his damages. As counsel for Field, the plaintiff, Adams felt confident in his understanding of the principles of law involved, but worried that the writ he prepared was unclerk-like, and thus he would fail. He had no experience in preparing such a document. His anguish was acute. He blamed Putnam for insufficient training. He blamed his mother for insisting he take the case, lest it be thought he was incapable of drawing a writ. Nothing, he decided, would ever come easily to him. "But it is my destiny to dig treasures with my own fingers," he wrote woefully. To gather strength, he read aloud from Cicero's Orations. The sweetness and grandeur of just the sounds of Cicero were sufficient reward, even if one understood none of the meaning. "Besides, it exercises my lungs, raises my spirits, opens my pores, quickens the circulation, and so contributes much to health." The case was the talk of the village. Everybody knew everybody involved. The justice of the peace, before whom Adams would appear, and the lawyer for Lambert were father and son, Colonel Josiah Quincy and young Samuel Quincy, a circumstance that obviously did not bode well for Adams and his client. Just as he feared, Adams lost on a technicality. He had neglected to include the words, "the county in the direction to the constables of Braintree." "Field's wrath waxed hot," he recorded, and his own misery was extreme. In his first appearance as a lawyer, he had been bested by a crude countryman like Lambert. He had been made to look a fool in the eyes of the whole town, and the humiliation and anger he felt appeared to have affected the atmosphere at home. The night following, a terrible family row broke out. Susanna Adams flew into a rage over the fact that Deacon John, in answer to his own conscience and feelings of responsibility as selectman, had brought a destitute young woman to live in the crowded household, the town having no means to provide for her. How was the girl to pay for her board, Susanna demanded of her husband, who responded by asserting his right to govern in his own home. I won't have the town's poor brought here stark naked for me to clothe for nothing, she stormed. He should resign as selectman. When the young woman, whose name was Judah, burst into tears and John's brother Peter pointed this out, Adams told him to hold his tongue, which touched Peter off, and all was breaking into flame. Adams was so shaken he had to leave the room and take up his Cicero again in order to compose himself. His mother's uncontrolled responses, her scolds, rages, were a grievous flaw, he felt. He knew the sudden, uncontrollable rush of his own anger, almost to the point of bursting. He must observe more closely the effects of reason and rage, just as he must never again undertake a case without command of the details. Let me never undertake to draw a writ without sufficient time to examine and digest in my mind all the doubts, queries, objections that may arise, he wrote. And he never did. The painful lesson had been learned. Henceforth, he vowed, he would bend his whole soul to the law. He would let nothing distract him. He drew inspiration from his Roman heroes. The first way for a young man to set himself on the road towards glorious reputation, he read in Cicero, is to win renown. Reputation, wrote Adams, ought to be the perpetual subject of my thoughts and aim of my behavior. Should he confine himself to the small stage of Braintree? Or would he be better off in Boston? But how possibly could anyone with an interest in life keep a clear head in Boston? My eyes are so diverted with chimney sweeps, carriers of wood, merchants, ladies, priests, carts, horses, oxen, coaches, market men and women, soldiers, sailors, and my ears with the rattle-gabble of them all that I can't think long enough in the street upon any one thing to start and pursue a thought. He felt anxious, eager after something, but what it was he did not know. I feel my own ignorance. I feel concerned for knowledge. I have a strong desire for distinction. I never shall shine till some animating occasion calls forth all my powers. It was 1760, the year 22-year-old George III was crowned king, and Adams turned 25. But if self-absorbed and ambitious, he was hardly more so than a number of other young men of ability of his time. The difference was that Adams wrote about it and was perfectly honest with himself. Why have I not genius to start some new thought? He asked at another point in his diary. Something that will surprise the world. Why could he not bring order to his life? Why could he not clear his table of its clutter of books and papers and concentrate on just one book, one subject? Why did imagination so often intervene? Why did thoughts of girls keep intruding? Ballast is what I want. I totter with every breeze. Chide himself as he would about time spent to little purpose, his appetite for life, for the pleasures of society, was too central to his nature to be denied. Further, he had a talent for friendship. To many he seemed prickly, intractable, and often he was. But as his friend Jonathan Sewell would write, Adams had a heart formed for friendship, and susceptible to the finest feelings. He needed friends, prized old friendships. He kept in touch with his Harvard classmates, and for several in particular maintained boundless admiration. Moses Hemingway, who had become a congregational minister known for his interminable sermons, would remain, in Adams's estimate, one of the first scholars of their generation. Samuel Locke, another from the class, was not only the youngest man ever chosen for the presidency of Harvard, but to Adams one of the best men ever chosen. Irrespective of the fact that Locke had had to resign after only a few years in office when his housemaid became pregnant. With his departure, in the words of one Harvard history, Locke was promptly forgotten. But not by John Adams. Friendship, Adams had written to his classmate and cousin Nathan Webb, is one of the distinguishing glories of man. From this, I expect to receive the chief happiness of my future life. When, a few years later, Webb became mortally ill, Adams was at his bedside keeping watch through several nights before his death. His current friends, Sewall, Richard Cranch, Parson Anthony Webber, were to be his friends to the last, despite drastic changes in circumstance, differing temperaments, eccentricities, or politics. When in time Adams became Richard Cranch's brother-in-law, he would sign his letters, "As ever, your faithful friend and affectionate brother John Adams," meaning every word. There was little he enjoyed more than an evening of spontaneous chatter, of stories by candlelight in congenial surroundings, of political and philosophic discourse, intimate, unreserved conversation, as he put it, and flirting, gallanting with the girls. He was lively, pungent, and naturally amiable. So amiable, as Thomas Jefferson would later write, that it was impossible not to warm to him. He was so widely read he could talk on almost any subject, sail off in almost any direction. What he knew well. Jonathan Sewall had already concluded that Adams was destined for greatness, telling him only partly in jest that in future ages, when New England shall have risen to its intended grandeur, it shall be as carefully recorded among the registers of the literati that Adams flourished in the second century after the exode of its first settlers from Great Britain, as it is now that Cicero was born in the 647th year after the building of Rome. Yet Adams often felt ill at ease, hopelessly awkward. He sensed people were laughing at him, as sometimes they were, and this was especially hurtful. He had a way of shrugging his shoulders and distorting his face that must be corrected, he knew. He berated himself for being too shy. "I should look bold, speak with more spirit." In the presence of women, those he wished to impress above all, he was too susceptible to the least sign of approval. "Good treatment makes me think I am admired, beloved. So I dismiss my guard and grow weak, silly, vain, conceited, ostentatious." Determined to understand human nature, fascinated by nearly everyone he encountered, he devoted large portions of his diary to recording their stories, their views on life, how they stood, talked, their facial expressions, how their minds worked. In the way that his literary commonplace book served as a notebook on his reading, his diary became his notebook on people. "Let me search for the clue which led great Shakespeare into the labyrinth of human nature. Let me examine how men think." He made close study of the attorneys he most admired, the Boston giants of the profession, searching for clues to their success. Jeremiah Gridley's grandeur emanated from his great learning, his lordly manner. The strength of James Otis was his fiery eloquence. "I find myself imitating Otis," wrote Adams. His portraits of original characters in and about Braintree were extraordinary, detailed, full of life and color, and written, obviously, like so much of the diary, out of the pure joy of writing. Possibly he knew what a gift he had as an observer of human nature. In another time, under different circumstances, he might have become a great novelist. That so many disparate qualities could exist in one person was of never-ending fascination to him. He longed to understand this in others, as in himself. The good-natured, obliging landlady of a friend was also a squatty, masculine creature with a great staring, rolling eye, a rare collection of disagreeable qualities. A tavern loafer of low and ignoble countenance, one Zab Hayward of Braintree, who had no conception of conventional grace in dancing or anything else, was nonetheless regarded as the best dancer in town. Adams sat one night in a local tavern observing from the sidelines. "Every room crowded with people," he recorded. "Negroes with a fiddle. Young fellows and girls dancing in the chamber as if they would kick the floor through." When at first Zab gathered a circle around him, his behavior and speeches were softly silly. But as his blood grew warm by motion and liquor, he grew droll. He caught a girl and danced a jig with her, and then led her to one side of the ring and said, "Stand there, I call for you by and by." This was spoken comically enough and raised a loud laugh. He caught another girl with light hair and a patch on her chin and held her by the hand while he sung a song. This tickled the girl's vanity, for the song which he applied to her described a very fine girl indeed. Adams's new friend, Pastor Anthony Wyberd, who had assumed the pulpit of Braintree's first church during the time Adams was away at Worcester, also became the subject of some of his most vivid sketches. Older than Adams by several years, Wyberd was, as would be said in understatement, somewhat eccentric, yet warmly esteemed. His pastorate would be the longest in the annals of the parish, lasting 45 years, and the friendship between Adams and Wyberd equally enduring. Privately, Adams wrote of him with the delight of a naturalist taking notes on some rare and exotic specimen. "Parson Wyberd is crooked. His head bends forward. His nose is a large Roman nose with a prodigious bunch protuberance upon the upper part of it. His mouth is large and irregular, his teeth black and foul and craggy. His eyes are a little squinted. His visage is long and lank, his complexion wan, his cheeks are fallen, his chin is long, large, and lean. When he prays at home, he raises one knee upon the chair and throws one hand over the back of it. With the other, he scratches his neck, pulls the hair of his wig. When he walks, he heaves away and swags one side and steps almost twice as far with one foot as the other. When he speaks, he cocks and rolls his eyes, shakes his head, and jerks his body about." Wyberd was slovenly and lazy. Yet, and here was the wonder, he had great delicacy of mind, judgment, and humor. He was superb in the pulpit. "He is a genius," Adams declared in summation. Parson Wyberd was one of the half-dozen or so bachelors in Adams's social circle. The two closest friends were Jonathan Sewell, a bright, witty fellow Harvard man and struggling attorney from Middlesex County, and Richard Cranch, a good-natured English-born clockmaker who knew French, loved poetry, and delighted in discussing theological questions with Adams. Bela Lincoln was a physician from nearby Hingham. Robert Treat Payne was another lawyer and Harvard graduate, whom Adams thought conceited, but who, like Wyberd and Sewell, had a quick wit, which for Adams was usually enough to justify nearly any failing. The preferred gathering place was the large, bustling Josiah Quincy household at the center of town, where a great part of the appeal was the Quincy family. Colonel Quincy, as an officer in the militia and possibly the wealthiest man in Braintree, was its leading citizen, but also someone Adams greatly admired for his polish and eloquence. Nothing so helped gain one command of the language, Quincy advised the young man, as the frequent reading and imitation of Swift and Pope. In addition to the lawyer son Samuel, there were sons Edmund and Josiah, who was also a lawyer, as well as a daughter, Hannah, and a cousin, Esther, who for Adams and his friends were the prime attractions. Esther was pert, sprightly, and gay. Hannah was all of that, and an outrageous flirt besides. While Jonathan Sewell fell almost immediately in love with Esther, whom he would eventually marry, Adams, Richard Cranch, and Bela Lincoln were all in eager pursuit of the high-spirited Hannah. Sensing he was the favorite, Adams was soon devoting every possible hour to her, and when not, dreaming of her. Nothing like this had happened to him before. His pleasure and distress were extreme, as he confided to his friend and rival, Cranch. "If I look upon a law book, my eyes, it is true, are on the book. But imagination is at a tea-table, seeing that hair, those eyes, that shape, that familiar friendly look. I go to bed and ruminate half the night, then fall asleep and dream the same enchanting scenes." All this was transpiring when the amorous spirits of the whole group appear to have been at a pitch. Adams recorded how one evening several couples slipped off to a side room and there laughed and screamed and kissed and hustled, and afterward emerged glowing like furnaces. After an evening stroll with Hannah through Braintree, through Cupid's Grove, Adams spent a long night and most of the next day with Parson Wyberd, talking and reading aloud from Benjamin Franklin's Reflections on Courtship and Marriage. "Let no trifling diversion or amusement or company decoy you from your books," he lectured himself in his diary. "I.e., let no girl, no gun, no cards, no flutes, no violins, no dress, no tobacco, no laziness decoy you from your books." Besides, he had moments of doubt when he thought Hannah less than sincere. "Her face and heart have no correspondence," he wrote. Then came the spring night he would remember ever after. Alone with Hannah at the Quincy house, he was about to propose when Cousin Esther and Jonathan Sewell suddenly burst into the room and the moment passed, never to be recovered. As it was, Bela Lincoln, the Hingham physician, increased his attentions, and in a year, he and Hannah Quincy would marry. Seeing what a narrow escape he had had, Adams solemnly determined to rededicate himself. Only by a turn of fate had he been delivered from dangerous shackles. "Let love and vanity be extinguished, and the great passions of ambition, patriotism, break out and burn," he wrote. Yet when he met Abigail Smith for the first time later that same summer of 1759, he would not be greatly impressed, not when he compared her to Hannah. Abigail and her sisters Mary and Elizabeth were the daughters of Reverend William Smith of Weymouth, the small seaport town further along the coast road. Adams's friend Cranch had lately begun calling on Mary, the oldest and prettiest of the three. On the evening he invited Adams to go along with him to meet Abigail, the middle sister, it was for Adams anything but love at first sight. In contrast to his loving, tender Hannah, these Smith sisters were, he wrote, neither fond, nor frank, nor candid. Nor did Adams much like the father, who seemed a crafty, designing man. Adams's first impressions were almost entirely bad, and, as he would come to realize, quite mistaken. The heaviest blow of his young life befell John Adams on May 25, 1761, when his father, Deacon John, died at age 70, the victim of epidemic influenza that took a heavy toll in eastern Massachusetts and on older people especially. In Braintree, 17 elderly men and women died. Adams's mother was also stricken, and though she survived, as she was to survive one epidemic after another down the years, she was too ill to leave her bed when her husband was buried. On the back of the office copy of his father's will, Adams wrote in his own hand the only known obituary of Deacon John. The testator had a good education, though not at college, and was a very capable and useful man. In his early life, he was an officer of the militia, afterwards a deacon of the church, and a selectman of the town. Almost all the business of the town being managed by him in that department for 20 years together. A man of strict piety and great integrity, much esteemed and beloved wherever he was known, which was not far, his sphere of life being not extensive. With his father gone, Adams experienced a want of strength and courage such as he had never known. Still, as expected of him, he stepped in as head of the family, and as time passed, those expressions of self-doubt, the fits of despair and self-consciousness that had so characterized the outpourings in his diary, grew fewer. With his inheritance, he became a man of substantial property by the measure of Braintree. He received the house immediately beside that of his father's, as well as 40 acres, 10 of adjoining land, plus 30 of orchard, pasture, woodland, and swamp, and slightly less than a third of his father's personal estate, since alone of the three sons he had been provided a college education. Adams was a freeholder now, and his thoughts took a decided turn to husbandry. He was soon absorbed in all manner of projects and improvements, working with several hired men, the help, as New Englanders said, building stone walls, digging up stumps, carting manure, plowing with 6 yoke of oxen, planting corn and potatoes. He loved the farm as never before, even the swamp, my swamp, as he wrote. His love of the law, too, grew greater. He felt privileged, blessed in his profession, he told Jonathan Sewell. Now to what higher object, to what greater character, can any mortal aspire than to be possessed of all this knowledge, well digested and ready at command, to assist the feeble and friendless, to discountenance the haughty and lawless, to procure redress to wrongs, the advancement of right, to assert and maintain liberty and virtue, to discourage and abolish tyranny and vice. In the house that was now his own, in what had once been the kitchen before a lean-to enlargement was added at back, he established his first proper law office. The room was bright and sunny, and in winter warmed by what had been the old kitchen fireplace. In the corner nearest the road he had an outside door cut, so that clients might directly come and go. His practice picked up. He was going to Boston now once or twice a week. Soon he was riding the circuit with the royal judges. I grow more expert. I feel my own strength. In November 1762, his friend Richard Cranch and Mary Smith were married, a high occasion for Adams that he hugely enjoyed, including the customary round of matrimonial stories shared among the men to raise the spirits, one of which he happily included in his journal. The story of B. Bicknell's wife is a very clever one. She said when she was married she was very anxious. She feared. She trembled. She could not go to bed. But she recollected she had put her hand to the plough and could not look back, so she mustered up her spirits, committed her soul to God and her body to B. Bicknell, and into bed she leaped. And in the morning she was amazed. She could not think for her life what it was that had so scared her. In the company of Richard Cranch, Adams had been seeing more and more of the Smith family, about whom he had had a change of heart. That his interest, at first informal, then ardent, was centered on Abigail was obvious to all. As an aspiring lawyer, he must not marry early, Jeremiah Gridley had warned. So it was not until October 25, 1764, after a courtship of nearly 5 years and just short of his 29th birthday, that John Adams's life changed as never before, when, at the Weymouth Parsonage, in a small service conducted by her father, he and Abigail Smith became husband and wife. Of the courtship, Adams had said not a word in his diary. Indeed, for the entire year of 1764, there were no diary entries, a sure sign of how preoccupied he was. At their first meeting in the summer of 1759, Abigail had been a shy, frail 15-year-old. Often ill during childhood, and still subject to recurring headaches and insomnia, she appeared more delicate and vulnerable than her sisters. By the time of her wedding, she was not quite 20, little more than 5 feet tall, with dark brown hair, brown eyes, and a fine pale complexion. For a rather stiff pastel portrait, one of a pair that she and John sat for in Salem a few years after their marriage, she posed with just a hint of a smile, 3 strands of pearls at the neck, her hair pulled back with a blue ribbon. But where the flat, oval face in her husband's portrait conveyed nothing of his bristling intelligence and appetite for life, in hers there was a strong, unmistakable look of good sense and character. He could have been almost any well-fed, untested young man, with dark, arched brows and a gray wig, while she was distinctly attractive, readily identifiable, her intent dark eyes clearly focused on the world. One wonders how a more gifted artist might have rendered Abigail. Long years afterward, Gilbert Stuart, while working on her portrait, would exclaim to a friend that he wished to God he could have painted Mrs. Adams when she was young. She would have made a perfect Venus, to which her husband, on hearing the story, expressed emphatic agreement. Year after year through the long courtship, John trotted his horse up and over Penn's Hill by the coast road 5 miles to Weymouth at every chance and in all seasons. She was his Diana, after the Roman goddess of the moon. He was her Lysander, the Spartan hero. In the privacy of correspondence, he would address her as Ever Dear Diana, or Miss Adorable. She nearly always began her letters then as later, My Dearest Friend. She saw what latent abilities and strengths were in her ardent suitor, and was deeply in love. Where others might see a stout, bluff little man, she saw a giant of great heart. And so it was ever to be. Only once before their marriage, when the diary was still active, did Adams dare mention her in its pages, and then almost in code. Di was a constant feast, tender, feeling, sensible, friendly, a friend. Not an imprudent, not an indelicate, not a disagreeable word of action. Prudent, soft, sensible, obliging, active. She, too, was an avid reader, and attributed her taste for letters to Richard Cranch, who, she later wrote, taught me to love the poets and put into my hands Milton, Pope, and Thompson, and Shakespeare. She could quote poetry more readily than could John Adams, and over a lifetime would quote her favorites again and again in correspondence, often making small, inconsequential mistakes, an indication that rather than looking passages up, she was quoting from memory. Intelligence and wit shined in her. She was consistently cheerful. She, too, loved to talk, quite as much as her suitor, and as time would tell, she was no less strong-minded. Considered too frail for school, she had been taught at home by her mother and had access to the library of several hundred books accumulated by her father. A graduate of Harvard, the Reverend Smith was adoring of all his children, who, in addition to the three daughters, included one son, William. "They must never speak unkindly of anyone," Abigail remembered her father saying repeatedly. "They must say only handsome things, and make topics rather than persons their subjects. Sensible policy for a parson's family." But Abigail had views on nearly everything and persons no less than topics. Nor was she ever to be particularly hesitant about expressing what she thought. Open in their affections for one another, she and John were also open in their criticisms. "Candor is my characteristic," he told her, as though she might not have noticed. He thought she could improve her singing voice. He faulted her for her parrot-toed way of walking and for sitting cross-legged. She told him he was too severe in his judgments of people and that to others often appeared haughty. "Besides," she chided him, "a gentleman has no business to concern himself about the legs of a lady." During the terrible smallpox epidemic of 1764, when Boston became one great hospital, he went to the city to be inoculated, an often harrowing, potentially fatal ordeal extending over many days. Though he sailed through with little discomfort, she worried excessively, and they corresponded nearly every day, Adams reminding her to be sure to have his letters smoked on the chance they carried contamination. The rambling, old-fashioned parsonage at Weymouth and its furnishings were a step removed from the plain farmer's cottage of John's boyhood or the house Abigail would move to once they were married. Also, two black slaves were part of the Smith household. According to traditional family accounts, the match was strongly opposed by Abigail's mother. She was a Quincy, the daughter of old John Quincy, whose big hilltop homestead, known as Mount Wollaston, was a Braintree landmark. Abigail, it was thought, would be marrying beneath her. But the determination of both Abigail and John, in combination with their obvious attraction to each other, like steel to a magnet, John said, were more than enough to carry the day. A month before the wedding, during a spell of several weeks when they were unable to see one another because of illness, Adams wrote to her, "Oh, my dear girl, I thank heaven that another fortnight will restore you to me, after so long a separation. My soul and body have both been thrown into disorder by your absence, and a month or two more would make me the most insufferable cynic in the world. I see nothing but faults, follies, frailties, and defects in anybody lately. People have lost all their good properties, or I, my justice or discernment. But you, who have always softened and warmed my heart, shall restore my benevolence as well as my health and tranquility of mind. You shall polish and refine my sentiments of life and manners, banish all the unsocial and ill-natured particles in my composition, and form me to that happy temper that can reconcile a quick discernment with a perfect candor. Believe me, now and ever, your faithful Lysander." His marriage to Abigail Smith was the most important decision of John Adams's life, as would become apparent with time. She was in all respects his equal, and the part she was to play would be greater than he could possibly have imagined, for all his love for her and what appreciation he already had of her beneficial, steadying influence. Bride and groom moved to Braintree the evening of the wedding. There was a servant to wait on them, the same Judah who had been the cause of the family row years before, who was temporarily on loan from John's mother. But as the days and weeks passed, Abigail did her own cooking by the open hearth, and while John busied himself with his law books and the farm, she spun and wove clothes for their everyday use. Her more sheltered, bookish upbringing notwithstanding, she was to prove every bit as hard-working as he, and no less conscientious about whatever she undertook. She was and would remain a thorough-going New England woman, who rose at 5 in the morning and was seldom idle. She did everything that needed doing. All her life she would do her own sewing, baking, feed her own ducks and chickens, churn her own butter, both because that was what was expected and because she knew her butter to be superior. And for all her reading, her remarkable knowledge of English poetry and literature, she was never to lose certain countrified Yankee patterns of speech, saying Canady for Canada, as an example, using set for sit, or the old New England aya for yes. To John's great satisfaction, Abigail also got along splendidly with his very unbookish mother. For a year or more, until Susanna Adams was remarried to an older Braintree man named John Hall, she continued to live with her son Peter in the family homestead next door. And the two women grew extremely fond of one another. To Abigail, her mother-in-law was a cheerful, open-minded person of exemplary benevolence, dedicated heart and soul to the welfare of her family, which was more than her eldest son ever committed to paper, even if he concurred. John and Abigail's own first child followed not quite 9 months after their marriage, a baby girl, Abigail or Nabby, who arrived July 14, 1765, and was, her mother recorded, the dear image of her still dearer papa. A second baby, John Quincy, was born 2 years later, and again in mid-July 1767. And Adams began worrying about college for Johnny, fine clothes for Nabby, dancing schools, and all that. To Abigail, after nearly 3 years of marriage, her John was still the tenderest of husbands, his affections unabated. For Adams, life had been made infinitely fuller. All the ties he felt to the old farm were stronger now with Abigail in partnership. She was the ballast he had wanted, the vital center of a new and better life. The time he spent away from home, riding the court circuit apart from her and the little ones, became increasingly difficult. "God preserve you and all our family," he would write. But in 1765, the same year little Abigail was born and Adams found himself chosen surveyor of highways in Braintree, he was swept by events into sudden public prominence. His marriage and family life were barely underway when he began the rise to the fame he had so long desired. "I never shall shine till some animating occasion calls forth all my powers," he had written. And here now was the moment. "I am, under all obligations of interest and ambition, as well as honor, gratitude, and duty, to exert the utmost of abilities in this important cause," he wrote. And with characteristic honesty, he had not left ambition out. The first news of the Stamp Act reached the American colonies during the last week of May 1765 and produced an immediate uproar, and in Massachusetts especially. Starting in November, nearly everything written or printed on paper, other than private correspondence and books, all pamphlets, newspapers, advertisements, deeds, diplomas, bills, bonds, all legal documents, ship's papers, even playing cards, were required to carry revenue stamps, some costing as much as £10. The new law, the first British attempt to tax Americans directly, had been passed by Parliament to help pay for the cost of the French and Indian War, and to meet the expense of maintaining a colonial military force to prevent Indian wars. Everyone was affected. The Boston Gazette reported Virginia in a state of utmost consternation. In August, Boston mobs, like devils let loose, stoned the residence of Andrew Oliver, secretary of the province, who had been appointed distributor of the stamps, then attacked and destroyed the house of Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson, wrongly suspecting him of having sponsored the detested tax. Adams, who had earlier joined a new law club in Boston started by Jeremiah Gridley, had, at Gridley's suggestion, been working on an essay that would become a dissertation on the canon and the feudal law. It was his first extended political work, and one of the most salient of his life, written at the age of 30. Now, at the height of the furor, he arranged for its publication as an unsigned, untitled essay in the Gazette. It would be published in England later in a volume entitled The True Sentiments of America. It was not a call to arms or mob action. With his countrymen's dislike of the Boston rabble, Adams was repelled by such an atrocious violation of the peace. The Stamp Act was hardly mentioned. Rather, it was a statement of his own fervent patriotism and the taproot conviction that American freedoms were not ideals still to be obtained, but rights long and firmly established by British law and by the courage and sacrifices of generations of Americans. Years later, Adams would say the Revolution began in the minds of Americans long before any shots were fired or bloodshed. "Be it remembered," he wrote in his dissertation, "that liberty must at all hazards be supported. We have a right to it, derived from our Maker. But if we have not, our fathers have earned and bought it for us at the expense of their ease, their estates, their pleasure, and their blood. And liberty cannot be preserved without a general knowledge among the people who have a right from the frame of their nature to knowledge, as their great Creator, who does nothing in vain, has given them understandings and a desire to know. But besides this, they have a right, an indisputable, unalienable, indefeasible divine right, to the most dreaded and envied kind of knowledge, I mean of the characters and conduct of their rulers." He was calling on his readers for independence of thought, to use their own minds. It was the same theme he had struck in his diary at Worcester a decade before, in the turmoil over what to do with his life, writing, "The point is now determined, and I shall have the liberty to think for myself." Government is a plain, simple, intelligent thing, founded in nature and reason, quite comprehensible by common sense, the dissertation continued. "The true source of our suffering has been our timidity. We have been afraid to think. Let us dare to read, think, speak, and write. Let it be known that British liberties are not the grants of princes or parliaments, that many of our rights are inherent and essential, agreed on as maxims and established as preliminaries even before Parliament existed. Let us read and recollect and impress upon our souls the views and ends of our more immediate forefathers in exchanging their native country for a dreary, inhospitable wilderness. Recollect their amazing fortitude, their bitter sufferings, the hunger, the nakedness, the cold, which they patiently endured, the severe labors of clearing their grounds, building their houses, raising their provisions, amidst dangers from wild beasts and savage men, before they had time or money or materials for commerce. Recollect the civil and religious principles and hopes and expectations which constantly supported and carried them through all hardships with patience and resignation. Let us recollect it was liberty, the hope of liberty for themselves and us and ours, which conquered all discouragements, dangers, and trials. The essay began appearing in the Gazette on August 12, 1765, and it struck an immediate chord. The author is a young man, not above 33 or 34, but of incomparable sense, wrote Boston's senior pastor, Charles Chauncey, to the learned Rhode Island clergyman and future president of Yale College, Ezra Stiles. I esteem that piece one of the best that has been written. It has done honor to its author, and it is a pity but he should be known. Soon afterward, Adams drafted what became known as the Braintree Instructions. Instructions from the freeholders of the town to their delegate to the General Court, the legislative body of Massachusetts, which, when printed in October in the Gazette, rang through the colony. We have always understood it to be a grand and fundamental principle of the English Constitution that no free man should be subject to any tax to which